you're listening to Death of the Reader. This is Flex and Herds here on your Murder Mystery World Tour. And Herds, we are returning to familiar territory today. Simon Brett.
The world famous Simon Brett, who we've had on award-winning show Death of the Reader.
That's right.
Last year.
Former president of the Detection Club, founded by Agatha Christie and co. in the 1930s. Simon Brett, A Decent Interval, was one of the first novels that I read while getting into actually solving murder mystery fiction.
Legend says that this is the first novel that you employed your patented technique on, which we might unveil through the course of this show.
Indeed we will.
Which terrifies me, Flex.
Herds,
I'm terrified.
It is a pleasure to be revisiting this novel, but I've got to say, 2.5 years down the line from when I first finished this novel, it might be more actually, I didn't really date it, but it's like reading a different novel coming back to this.
Really?
It's really weird. I don't know what changed for me personally in reading this novel, but I felt, I guess, a lot more uncomfortable reading it this time through.
How so?
First of all, before we get in, we should say we are covering chapters 1 to 11 on the show today.
Yes.
And that means we have gotten up to just after the murder has happened and our detective, Charles Paris, has been interrogated by the police.
Which is an interesting turn of circumstance for the detective to be the one being detectived. I will say also, I wasn't sure if I was going to get a murder this time around, or a body, I should say, when Mr. Jared Root ended up with his right side of his body crushed by furniture, by the scenery, by a giant skull collapsing on him, apparently.
My initial plan for this novel was to break it up so you saw Jared Root getting crushed, we'd end it there, and then you'd see the actual murder in part two. But the book was differently paced to how I remember it.
Well, that's all right. I'll be honest, I've been focusing much more on the actual murder, so it's a good thing you were like, oh, you should solve who crushed Jared Root, because I would not have had nearly as clear of a picture of such things.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm looking forward to solving this one. I think some things are jumping out at me pretty quickly on this one, so I'm looking forward to getting to part three and getting to talk about that. But you say you've been having some problems. It's a little bit foreign to you, this novel. It doesn't feel the same after, you know, 2.5 years of experience with others?
Yeah, I think the main thing that stood out to me is that the first time through this novel, I kind of read it through and I'd assumed that all of the things that Charles Paris said were meant to be character flaws. Like, there's many scenes of him drinking, of him objectifying women, about him complaining about feminism, him complaining about Facebook and Twitter and all of those things.
I mean, the very first scene that we have with him is him saying, I was watching this program with a feminist on it, and all he could do was look at her with her breasts, and I wasn't sure whether that was offensive, but it probably was. Like, he is clearly meant to be sympathetic, but he is so out of touch.
I know.
It is blinding.
And the thing that, you know, the first time through, I assumed that these were all character flaws, and I was like, oh, you know, this is all, you know, obviously very, you know, very indicative of who Charles Paris is, an out of touch old man, out of the world.
Yep.
But reading it through the second time, I was getting a little concerned because it started to feel to me like, well, if we were meant to highlight that he was out of touch, why are we actually spending all of this time on these descriptions? Why are we constantly throwing back to the same jokes? It felt like it thought it was being funnier than it was, and I was concerned that maybe the book was actually coming from the opposite perspective, that it is the world who is out of touch.
Well, I'll let you know that I actually listened to the audiobook for this one.
Yeah.
I have not touched the actual physical novel, so heresy, I know.
Heresy.
But I've really enjoyed listening to Simon Brett, actually, through, I believe it's Isis Audio Productions.
Yeah.
It's the company that produced it. But he reads his own novel, and the way that he delivers those lines, particularly when he's talking about sexual encounters and
sexual,
all that sort of thing.
Sexual, I believe he pronounces it.
Like, he is hamming it up.
Yeah.
I have no doubt in my own mind that he is intending this as a joke, as a bit of a jab at Charles Paris himself.
It definitely can be a bit grating, and I still hold to my original opinion that I think that it is meant to be all his character flaws, because the book is far too self-aware of all of the things he is unaware of.
Sure.
But yeah, I think that Charles Paris is a very interesting character because he is one of a generation of detectives who are built on their flaws, particularly that post kind of noir crime era where we get away from the eccentricities elevating the character as we do with Hercule Poirot. We get away from the manly manness of Roderick Allen in Nioh Marsh. We get away from Father Brown, who
Oh, okay, fair enough.
And we get into this realm of detectives in the modern day who have just outstanding character flaws. I think that if you look at the way that these flaws are written into the novel, there's a lot of commitment to it, which is why I think I found it uncomfortable going back to it again.
Yeah.
But it's that same level of commitment that I think makes me understand why someone as multifaceted and talented as Bill Nighy was cast to play him in various dramas and adaptations of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a character that is in such depth, even with such a, you know, short portrayal, that you can really see how someone like Bill Nighy would be able to actually, you know, flex those acting chops in that role.
No, for
and
sure.
I'd really love to, at some point on the show, maybe actually sit down and look at one of those adaptations.
I'd love to. Maybe we do that after we finish this up. I know that, yeah, there is an adaptation of this novel here, of a decent interval.
Are you about to take more points away from me by not letting me solve another book, Herds?
I mean, I was planning on it, but when you put it that way, maybe that's too obvious. Maybe I need to find a more surreptitious way of
doing
it.
That's right. You're still in the lead. I have ground to gain.
It's true. I'm winning for once. I'll take it. No, for sure. No, I definitely agree with you. I think that the consistency with which Charles Parris's flaws are brought up, it's clearly going to tie into the rest of the novel. I think it's also probably going to tie into the actual solving of the case, which I'm looking forward to. And I really enjoy, I want to give a shout out, his lovely wife, Frances.
Yes.
Who
just the most tolerant individual ever.
Well, she's constantly throwing him around. Like, she's constantly putting his back to the wall, saying, well, that's not really what you meant. And, like, who are you involved with? Why? Like, we haven't spoken in so long. Like, she's just constantly putting him up against the wall and pointing out his flaws. And I really appreciated that.
Yeah.
I'm kind of loving this because, as you point out, almost all of the detectives that we've had on the show, even I would say the Knives Out, which we, you know, really enjoyed last year, all the detectives are nearly flawless in their depiction.
Mm.
And so getting to actually do a proper study on a detective as out of touch, as, you know, away from not just the world, but also the process of solving the murder case. He's openly being interrogated. He is the primary suspect of the murder.
Yeah.
And not to the point where it's, you know, turned into a crime novel. He's being chased around by police cars quite, but he's clearly being portrayed in a very vulnerable state, which I really appreciate in a protagonist. I like to write and I like to read a lot of protagonists that have a vulnerability to them so that we can really see, you know, them push past that. And indeed, Charles Parris is trying to better himself, even if he fails miserably by having the old bells every single night.
Yeah. I think one of the other things that is excellent about the portrayal of Parris in this novel is the way that it reframes the standard device of the amateur detective versus the police.
Yeah.
Because obviously, I think particularly with Sherlock Holmes, that's kind of a big part of the narrative, is that the amateur detective is kind of working under the noses of, but still against the police.
Mm-hmm.
And this just takes it to the next level of, you know, as you say, the detective just outright being suspected by the police.
I found it really interesting because this is yet another murder mystery set in a theater, which I love, by the way. But the fact that we've chosen Hamlet specifically and portrayed Charles as the ghost of all the characters, because if you're not familiar with Hamlet, which, you know, you should be familiar with the story if you've ever been through a high school, you know, English class. But the character of Hamlet's father's ghost beseeches Hamlet to pursue his own killer. That's kind of the ghost role in the story. It's the call to action in the hero's journey, all that sort of thing.
Mm.
Which is interesting in that with the death of Miss Katrina, which we'll get to later, Charles is both working as the ghost, seeking to figure out who the killer is as a detective, but is also acting in the role of Hamlet, which I found to be particularly interesting.
Mm.
It almost makes me wonder if the police are going to turn to the role of Fortinbras, which again, if you're not familiar with, they're foils to each other, Hamlet and Fortinbras. Yeah. Whereas Hamlet, his father is killed, and so he seeks most doggedly to find who has killed them, what has happened, and like seek the truth. Fortinbras raises an army and goes off to capture a hill that doesn't matter to anybody. So I wonder if by the end of this novel, we're going to have the police, you know, come in with some, you know, entirely inconsequential, you know, solving of the case, or worse, to take the credit of Hamlet, of Charles at the end, which is very interesting.
Yeah, no, that definitely is a fun possibility. And I think the other thing that's very interesting is, having spoken with Simon Brett last year, he was saying that a lot of his writings reflect his interest in the arts and media. And I think that that's very apparent in the writing here. It tackles it in a very upfront way with a lot of modern references that you wouldn't see out of a lot of other writers. You know, even when we look at Dame Naomarsh, when we look at Agatha Christie, they were people who were elevated in society for their contributions and revival of their respective theatre scenes. Mm. But Simon Brett tackles it in a way that is much more upfront and highlighting the problems of the theatre in a, you know, not a way that was exclusive from how the others were doing it, but I think that it's very present, and I like the way that it actually deals with the issues so just in your face.
Yeah. I really appreciate how critical he is of a career in acting in particular, which is something that I've been cautioning and time and time again. You know, if you go for a career in acting, you should have a fallback, because, you know, your chances are one in a million, and those one in a million chances are so huge. You become a celebrity and you have this whole like reality television show based around your life or whatever on, you know, Star Hunt or Top Pop, which are names that are just real enough that I can hate them. like, there's no other way to put it,
excellent,
honestly.
Way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah. But the way that he kind of critiques the clash between modern theater, and television shows, how they're two very different types of mediums, and particularly the managers of the talent that they're having in the play, that being Jared Root and Katrina,
yes,
forget her last name, but the two of those being brought on to elevate the show without having any actual acting talent, even if they might be excellent personalities. They have the egos to match, you know, those reality TV shows where you need those big personalities to push performances of those shows. And
so
that when the editing crew gets in and, you know, they can work their magic, they have a lot to work with. But obviously for a theater space, it's not really what you're looking for. It's only going to cause problems.
Yeah. And I think that particularly the way that we look at the engagement between the social media and reality TV side of things, there's, I wouldn't necessarily say a level of understanding in how Simon Brett approaches it, but I think a great level of awareness in how a lot of it is very fleeting, and the book kind of tries to highlight that. It's almost a side metaphor for the standard thing about death, you know, life is fleeting and we should capture every moment, and we're juxtaposing it with the social media narrative, which I think is very standard for modern novels, but I like the execution a lot here.
I will say I like the excuse that Simon Brett is cleverly using by having this old fart detective in that he can still address social media without having to get into the nitty gritty of it. Like, it's, from my perspective, a very good excuse for Simon Brett as a writer to not have to show an intimate understanding of all of the social media trends that have ever existed, because, you know, social media, Twitter and Facebook are such ever-evolving platforms in that regard.
Yeah.
I think it really helps him to focus on the people and the places and say, yes, social media exists. Yes, it's important, but we don't need to, you know, dig through Katrina's Twitter history and see who she's following.
Yeah.
Like, we just need to know that she has, you know, thousands of followers compared to Jared's millions. That's all that we need to know.
Yeah. It's actually kind of quite curious now that you mention it. I don't think I've ever read a crime fiction novel that just dealt with social media up front. I'm sure that they're out there and I just haven't read them. But, you know, the only one that I can think of is the BBC Sherlock series.
Right, right.
And even then, it's just like he's flicking images of social media
trying
away
to
in
find
front
the
of
important
him.
Thing, yeah.
Yeah, and I'd be very interested to see how younger writers, as they start to come through, will start reinterpreting what it means to have digital media and connectivity in a genre that is so typically closed off.
Yeah. I have not had the pleasure of reading a murder mystery that tackles social media particularly well. There was an episode of Black Mirror that I don't know was brilliant, but it involved, one of the characters was committing a crime. And so the police were trying to figure out, you know, who is this guy? Why are they kidnapped? Were these employees of this big social media company? What's going on? And then the people who were working at the social media company came into the police's headquarters and said, well, we've looked through his tweets and we've figured out exactly who he is and what he wants.
Yeah.
And then they use that information to try to coach their CEO to talk to the guy and try and get him to step back from the criminal act that he's currently undertaking and like let the hostage go.
It's
really clever.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously we have plots about precognition in crime, and that's kind of very popular, and it'll again be interesting to see how those are reinterpreted given the modern level of engagement with social media. Anyhow, you are listening to Death of the Reader. We are Flex and Herds discussing A Decent Interval by Simon Brett, chapters 1 to 11 here on Death of the Reader. We will be back in just a second. You're listening to Death of the Reader. This is Flex and Herds bringing you A Decent Interval by Simon Brett here on your Murder Mystery World Tour on 2SER. And Herds, I have a deliberation for you to make.
Oh, do you? Oh, I'm scared. This is not what I was expecting.
We have agreed that this year on Death of the Reader is double or nothing.
Yes.
Every book is worth 2 points. Mm. And at the end of the year, whoever has the lowest goes to zero.
Yes. I'm in.
Now, the Herds.
Deliberation?
Yeah. The deliberation I have for you to make
is
you get to pick where your 2 points come from.
Okay.
If you think you can solve this novel this week, you can have 1 point for trying to solve it this week and 1 point for trying to solve it the next. Or you can take a reprieve if you can solve the method and the culprit of both the crushing and the killing, you can have your 2 points.
I'll be honest, I don't know that I can solve the method of the crushing. I am not prepared for that. So I suppose I'll take trying to solve the proper murder or the manslaughter, as it may be.
All right.
But yeah.
So I'm looking forward to hearing your solution on the show this week then.
All right. Herds,
because the stakes have just been raised.
All right, I'm into it.
Now, Herds, I think the first thing we should go over is the separation between the two crimes, one of which we don't even really know is a crime, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
There is the crushing of Jared Root.
Mm-hmm.
Immobilizing him, taking him out of the starring role, and the murder of Katrina.
Manslaughter.
Yes. Maybe.
Maybe. We'll see. That's something I'm working on.
Jared Root is found after a loud crash is heard on the stage and people rush to find him crushed underneath a large skull, which Charles Paris notices is fortunately just light enough to have not killed the man.
Yes.
Only dislocating his collarbone, I believe.
I mean, we literally have a discussion in a bar, you know, some mysterious voice saying, oh, yeah, I totally did the deed, but if you don't pay me, then there'll be more deeds to come. Mm-hmm. And he bats his evil eyelashes at the camera just off screen so he can't tell who it is. I think it's pretty clear to say that Jared's crushing was a deliberate design here by someone who wanted him out of the picture, perhaps even done by some kind of professional.
Or it could be said that it was a opportunistic taking of credit to try and get some additional leverage behind the scenes.
Maybe.
I wouldn't discount that so easily. And then, of course, we have our murder where, during the decent interval, Charles Paris rushes in to the main actor's dressing room to find her strewn across the ground, dead.
Yes, Katrina.
Pulled in blood.
Katrina of Star Hunt fame is found with blood everywhere, and it looks like she's been rubbing at her eye, which I find to be a very curious detail. I'm going to let you know, I'm working with two concurrent theories right now.
Excellent.
Which is the fun part of this show, because I will tell you the very first thing that I thought when he walked into the star dressing room, because up until this point, I thought, all right, so clearly Jared was attempted to be taken out of the picture and that didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly, what's-his-face, Will, was very excited to get the new part. Maybe there's something going on there, who knows? But clearly, somebody wanted Jared, you know, out of the picture, and now Sam has been brought in to play the role of Hamlet.
And seems to be given much more credit than one would normally assume for the role.
Yes, yes. This is where my brain is torn between two possibilities here.
Excellent.
Because we know that it was a last minute change that brought Katrina to the star dressing room, and it seems like she officiated that all on her own. So the question that I have is who and this is why I'm a little bit scared, but who knew that she had actually changed dressing rooms? Because I think that that's going to play into our solution here.
You think that she was offered the change of dressing rooms to get her in position for the murder?
It doesn't sound like she was offered it. It sounds like she had a hostile takeover. I believe the analogy that they use is as of Hitler annexing some particular country. And it sounds like it wasn't offered. It sounds like it was a pretty spontaneous act, possibly while the play was going on. That's what it sounds like. And so I'm torn between two possibilities here. Either somebody who knew that Katrina was being moved is responsible, which pretty well puts anybody acting in the play out of the picture, because they would have been on stage or otherwise rehearsing their lines, preparing for the show. I definitely think the killer we're looking for is somewhere either in the stage crew or the production team, for sure. The other option, of course, is that the person who has arranged for this death was not aware that Katrina would be in there. And that's the part that I'm struggling with, because there was blood on the floor, which implies that the murder happened in person. But Katrina was seen, or was presumably rubbing her eye shortly before the murder occurred, which seems like there's been some tampering with the makeup. It seems like what might have been going on there. She's like, oh, I've got like poison on my face. That's the part that I'm struggling with. Those are the two concurrent theories that I have. And I think that the people who most directly benefit from either of the two star actors going under for Katrina is obviously Millie. And I will say, due to the rubbing at the eye and whatever seems to have gone on here, it implies that there's been a very kind of amateur approach to this kill. It seems like things either didn't go to plan or like the kill was particularly brutal. I don't know. I'm not sure what's going on in that room there. I'm looking for clarification.
Well, I think that you're on the right trail. The murder did indeed happen in the room.
Sure. I'm just saying, I think that if the intended target was Katrina, I think that it is most likely Millie who has done the deed.
You don't at all suspect her manager, who would be the one at her beck and call and likely would have known exactly where she was.
I think that she's far too directly related to the victim to have done it. I think that...
You feel like it would be career suicide, per se, for her to be involved
yes,
with the murder.
I definitely think so. I think that Millie makes a lot of sense. I've also noted that a lot of the thematic conflict in the novel is around generation differences.
Yes.
I think that our killer is more likely to be one of the younger actors in the performance.
Really?
Which coincidentally also narrows our pool pretty substantially.
I would have maybe thought the other way around if it was meant to be about generational conflict, that the younger actress would have been taken out by one of the older members.
Well, none of the older actors stand to gain. I will say, though, Gertrude's actress Geraldine is raising some eyebrows. I think that she's a red herring, though. I don't think that she's the killer. Because what is her motive?
Well, here's the thing I want to pose to you, Herds, is that you've kind of thrown earlier in the show this theory about how the novel might follow the whims of Hamlet, the stage play that it is set around. And I'm curious if you think that the murder will be the same, or if maybe the murder will, for example, follow one of the other analogies, such as, you know, the annexation of countries by Hitler.
Sure.
If we can maybe expect to find out that the annexation ended in suicide when the Russians came and knocking on the door.
I don't think this is suicide somehow. Okay. I don't think so. Like, poison in the eye is not a great way to commit suicide, let's put it that way. Also, why would Katrina do that? She's young and full of vigor. I think that it is much more likely that we're dealing with one of the younger actors, because Geraldine, despite being constantly raising red flags, is not very present. I think that it's the trigger that I need to figure out going forward in the story is whether or not Katrina was the intended victim. Because if she was, then I think it's got to be Millie. She's the person who stands the most to gain here. It also puts her in on the same star level, even if she can't act as well, as her boyfriend, Sam. I think she's a pretty obvious contender for killer. On the other hand, and this is the thing, this is a character that jumped out at me almost immediately as like, obviously the killer because of how passionate they are. Mm-hmm. It's Will. I forget his last name, but Will is the understudy for Hamlet. And I think that Jared's crushing was deliberately arranged. I think that that is the case.
You're telling me that the man that stands to gain the position of Hamlet by killing the man playing Hamlet would be the one to kill Hamlet?
Yes.
Okay.
Here's the thing. I don't think that Sam is behind... Oh, sorry. Not Sam, rather. Sam Will. Hadn't been introduced at the
Will.
Time. Will. I don't think that Will was behind the crushing. I love that we just call it the crushing, but...
I mean, what else are we going to call
it? I don't think that Will was behind the crushing of Jared earlier in the novel. It sounds like there's money involved, and I don't think that Will has that kind of money. Mm-hmm. He seems like a scrappy kid. I think it's more likely that somebody else has arranged for this crushing and that he's, you know, seeing this opportunity to step in the limelight. And he mentioned that, like, he's super excited and he knows all the lines and he wants to get his father in. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't seem entirely there, honestly, mentally. I think that if it turns out that, you know, for example, that Millie didn't know that that Sam had changed rooms, I think that he is a much more likely culprit. And honestly, just by his behavior alone, by how excited he was and that extra kind of twinge of like, oh, my father's going to come and see the play, I think that he is a more likely culprit out of the two of them. I think that either he's tried to actually kill Sam via this poison to the eye, or he's tried to sabotage them, realize that he's got the wrong person, tried to silence them by like beating their head in.
Yep.
We haven't had a proper kind of examination of the crime scene yet, so I'm kind of waiting on that for the final verdict. But honestly, I think that especially since we haven't addressed the fact that that Katrina switched rooms so late in the kind of in the performance,
yeah,
I think that he's a much more likely culprit.
Well, Herds, I'm curious as to whether you think this can stand as a final theory. You reckon that Will is the one responsible?
Yes.
For
yes.
both incidents?
No. I'm not sure. This is why I didn't put points on Jared. Uh-huh. I could not tell you. I'm not sure how I'm supposed to figure out who has crushed Jared. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a lot that stood out to me as particular evidence, except that whoever is doing it has money. So very it's likely either Ned English, who is the director and has been pretty flustered with him. Mm-hmm. I think he's probably the most likely culprit because he's just been so completely, you know, fed up with him.
I will say, I think one of the things that's confusing at this point in the book, because it doesn't really ever quite elaborate on it, is the reputation of the theater company that is putting on the show.
Sure.
I think that it kind of is meant to have a poor reputation and, you know, doesn't pay very well, which is an interesting thing to lend to your theory there, the idea that there are only so many characters who would actually have money to throw around behind the scenes.
The only characters who really could fit that bill are Ned English, who's a maybe. The person with the most money is Tony, the producer of the show. Mm-hmm. So if we're looking for someone with means, he certainly fits the bill. But I don't know why he would want to crush his star actor when they're one of the two drivers of popularity of the show. That seems like a pretty dumb
move. Unless, of course, he was trying to gain the publicity by crushing the more popular man.
You know what? I'm in on that. That sounds like a theory to me because I don't know. Like, I think that Ned English is frustrated.
Surely hurts. You would want to get rid of your two worst actors while generating the most publicity about their removal, which is exactly what's happened here. Personally, I think that the people that stand the most to gain here is everyone except the people who died.
I mean, that's not unfair to say. That's the thing, though. I think that you can spin, and this is something that I've learned. Maybe I'll talk about more this next week, but I play a lot of mafia games, a lot of werewolf games. And one of the things that you can do as the informed, more powerful party who's trying to hide the truth is that you could spin logic any which way you possibly can. And I think you could spin any of the characters, except maybe Dennis, into being the killer. But I think that the trick that stands out the most to me is the fact that the rooms were switched. And I think that the only character who really stands out to me, if Sam was the intended target for the murder, is Will himself. So I'm going to pin it on him. I'm going to say that he's put some kind of poison in her makeup, which is, again, a classic of the theater genre, and that maybe he realized he'd got the wrong target. And so we just decided, well, might as well finish her off.
In for a penny, in for a pound.
Pretty much. Yeah, and I think he's done it to try and get the role of Hamlet in Hamlet.
All right. Well, yeah. Herds, thank you for locking in your theory.
There it is.
I'm excited to break it down next week, see what did and did not work out for you.
Let's see how we go.
The question I have before we leave today, Herds, is no points on the table.
Mm.
Do you think the shady man taking credit for the crushing of Jared Root was the one responsible?
Yes. Yes.
All right.
I do think so.
Fantastic. Well, Herds, next week we are going to be covering chapters 12 to 19 of A Decent Interval by Simon Brett. We will see you next week on Death of the Reader. Your Flex and Herds, thank you very much for joining us. Have fun.
We'll see you next time.